Coming to you direct from the nerve center of the galaxy's greatest comic. This is the 2000 AD Thrillcast.
Borag Thung, Earthlets, tis I, Molchar, your host of the 2000 AD Thrillcast Lockdown Tapes. I hope you are all keeping well. This week, we're not talking about a 2000 AD publication. We're talking about a new book out from Sequart called Judging Dread, which has been edited by Scott Weatherly and is a series of essays examining the world of Judge Dredd from different perspectives. So you've got pieces on the Dark Judges, on surveillance technology, on robots in Dredd's world, on issues of peace and security in kind of like the post 9/11 world and whatnot. Really great and fascinating book. It's got a foreword by Matt Smith, Tharg's underling, and an interview with Dredd writer Rob Williams. And it's available from Sequart. Just putting it in front of the camera for those watching on YouTube. That's available from their website. So what I thought it'd be really interesting to do, because it's so great to see other publishers begin to explore and examine Dredd in interesting ways beyond the stuff that that we at Rebellion put out. I thought it'd be great to get Scott and a couple of the writers onto the podcast to just talk things through. So we've got Scott, we've got Tony Farina, and we've got Julian Darius, who is founder of Sequart. So really great chat between the four of us about issues within Judge Dredd, our own reaction to Judge Dredd. Tony and Julian are both American, so they bring a perspective as well. For Scott, this is the first time he's actually edited something along these lines. So it's fantastic that he's chosen to focus on Judge Dredd. So we're going to hear from them in a little bit. Should be a good chat. In the meantime, I hope you are all keeping up to date on the latest news from 2000 AD at 2000ad.com/newsletter with the weekly thrill mail that goes out every Wednesday. And also, we have got some absolutely cracking collections coming up over the next few months. We've got the Hershey collection, Rob Williams and Simon Fraser. We've got Dreadnoughts, which is Michael Carroll, John Higgins and Sarah Jane Hurst. We've got the Megatropolis collection by Kenneth Neumann and Dave Taylor. Such a strong back end list of this year. So newsletter is one way to keep up. Go along to 2080.com and explore the stuff that we've got in the shop. That's enough blurb for now. So we're going to crack on and hear from Tony Farina, Julian Darius, Scott Weatherly, and myself about Judging Dredd. So it's wonderful to welcome our guests to this special episode where we're talking about this book, Judging Dredd, Examining the World of Judge Dredd, which is out from Sequart. And we are joined by Scott Weatherly, who's the editor and has written one of the essays as well. Hello, Scott.
Hi, how are you doing? Yes, editor, contributor, and... I was painting Julian's butt whilst I was doing it as well. So,
We've got Julian Darius, who not only is a contributor to the book, but is also one of the brains behind the publishers Sequart.
Yes, welcome. It's an honour to be here.
Excellent. And we've also got Tony Farina, who's written one of the essays in the book. Hi, Tony.
Hello, hello. I think this is so insane. I told people that we've been invited on and they were like, what now? What's happening? So it's very cool. Thanks for having us, Mike.
No worries. I generally get so little feedback about the podcast. Quite often it's just like, just broadcasting it into the ether and just going, well, I'll do the next episode then. So I never think that people actually might listen to it. Anyway, so we're here to talk about Judging Dredd because, this is just out from Sequart and it's Scott, you yes. explain what this book is before I put words into your mouth.
To be fair, what it is it's a collection of essays. Wait a minute. dog. Right, so it's a collection of essays from a number of contributors all over the world, actually. We've got some fantastic guys. I put an open thing out to contributors. We've got guys from America, Europe, Bangladesh. It's a fantastically diverse cast of people, all providing an angle and an analysis on an element of Judge Dredd and his wider world. And I mean, not to put words in Julian's mouth, but really the sort of the objective of Sequoia and the books is to provide sort of an accessible but sort of academic analysis on comics. And that's sort of what we try to do. I will say I'm not an academic. I'm, you know, basically like yourself, a roving podcaster that sort of was allowed to do this. And so it's not a dry academic sort of like scholarly piece. It's designed for fans to try and get a different approach on it. So that's sort of what it is. But what it came out of was literally me saying, well, there's not a book in Sequoia about Judge Dredd.
Wait, Julian, when Scott said that, what was your initial reaction?
Well, Scott's my bud. So my initial reaction was, hell yes, how do we make this work? And I'm a lifelong 2000 AD fan, and Judge Dredd in particular. And, you know, I wanted to say that, you know, 2000 AD was super important to me, especially as a kid, being a kid in the 80s and an adolescent in the 90s. A very conformist time, maybe not quite as bad as Thatcher, but a pretty oppressive time for me. You know, having these odd little 2000 AD collections in the back of comic stores were like a glimpse into another world that was so exciting for me. So making sure that a Brit was the editor, you know, and nobody else could do it but Scott.
Well, I guess we'll come on to talk about the culture surrounding Judge Dredd and everything in a minute. Tony, when I'm presuming, and again to put words into your mouth, that you saw the shout out for essays, and this is something that you decided to get involved with. Is that how it worked?
Yeah. So Scott, I've got a show, Indie Comic Spotlight. It's called, and Scott was on. Early on when I first started it about a year and a half ago now, I had Scott on as the Dredd guy. I was like, I'm doing Dredd. There's one person I need. And I didn't know Scott yet. I had just listened to a show. I was a fan. And I'm like, well, this is the guy. So I reached out to him, and it was great because I was kind of a Dredd novice, as it were. I didn't grow up with it. Like for me, the indie comics I read were more like Eclipse and Parody Press and stuff like that. Like, you know, American kind of counterculture stuff. But I knew it, you know, I had read America because I don't know how you don't read that. And so I knew enough to get in trouble, the IDW run. So when Scott put that out, after having a great chat with him, I was like, done. I mean, Days of Chaos is my focus. And that was actually when I read fresh for this one. I had not read that yet. But once I was like, this is the storyline that I find fascinating. So when he put that out, I was like, I'm going to start digging in, to that whole kind of privacy thing, because, you know, I live in America where we're always under surveillance. So it just was a no-brainer. So I was just thrilled. I pitched it to him. I know it morphed a little from what I originally pitched to what it ended once I actually read, you know, Days of Chaos four times. But I think it came out. I think it came out okay.
I guess the initial question that needs asking is, why do you guys think that Judge Dredd as a character, as a comic book, is worthy of being examined? Because it's always that thing whenever you know, I see comics criticism online, or I go off on one in the pub, there's always that little voice that says, you know, it's just comic books. Why are you reading so much into this? What's your guys' take on that?
To be fair, I'm going to hand off to Julian first because of why he created Sequoia, to be fair, for this very purpose. And then I'll give, you know, the Dredd answer. But I think, you know, Julian, I will hand off to you first, being there, you know, from the Sequoia angle.
Well, you're very kind, Scott. You know, I mean, the whole point of Sequoia, founded in the 90s, was to say that comics can be as moving and as important and as complex as the art in any other medium, which is something that I passionately believe and I still believe. Judge Dredd has not only the longevity, but the depth of stories, stories that I'm sure have moved all four of us. I've cried at Judge Dredd. I've been angry at Judge Dredd. And between him and his wider world, you can do anything with that universe. And there have been just decades of titanic creators, people who we all admire, people who could stand up to the work in any other medium, who have worked on this evolving epic, the sprawling, you know, multiverse of stories. So to me, you know, it's a no-brainer. I mean, Judge Dredd is of that caliber and can stand alongside Batman or anybody else.
Yeah, I think from my point of view, I think for Dredd in particular, I mean, you know, I came on Sequoia, I sort of met, you know, Julian through sort of some of the books and you know, we've become friends and through that. And so comic criticism and analysis has been fascinating to me to learn more about it and the ways and the means of it. But I grew up with Dredd, much like these guys. You know, I'm a typical Brit kid. I started on the Beano and the Dandy. And then when I got to a point where I was like, you know, these aren't violent enough, I want something else. I came across, and it's in the introduction, I came across the complete Judge Dredd as the, you know, the reprinting, and I sort of came across the Cursed Earth saga. And when I came across it, and then I was introduced sort of to a late 80s, 89, 90, sort of, I got into 2000 AD and from there. And when I was a kid, it's very much sort of like, you know, oh, this is amazing. It's, you know, you the 2000 in particular, you have all the characters and they got the sort of like, it could be done, just read as a pulpy sci-fi anthology. And I enjoyed it as such. And then as I've got older, I'm able to go back now and look at it and go, yeah, this actually, like, John Wagner was, you know, was doing, you know, important work, really, from a critical and satirical point of view, you know. And it made me laugh that sort of looking at this, as especially like people hold up like RoboCop as a you know, a satire of 80s corporate culture and, you know, tech, you know, demand. And I'm like, yeah, but Judge Dredd was doing that before. And in some cases, much better. As Julian said, it's 44 years, 40 plus years now of stories, you know, satirizing different parts of British, American, or world culture. And some of it's some of the best satire to read, because you don't have to read it as satire. If you want to read it as satire, it is there. And some of it is cutting. But also, you can enjoy the stories as, you know, a pulp, dark comic adventure series.
Yeah. And for me, coming at it, like, as a somebody who, like, I used to teach literary criticism. It's something that is important to me. Like, just as a person, I'm always trying to see things through that lens. And I believe that what Julian said is true, that all forms of art are, you know, they have they're valid. And that for somebody to say to you, like, why are you spending all your time reading these comic books? Like, well, it's because you haven't read one. And that would always just be the answer I would say to anybody. Why are you wasting your time with fill in the blank? Generally, that means whoever's saying that doesn't understand the thing and doesn't want to take the time to understand the thing. And so to me, the idea of writing about Dredd in particular is because, unlike other comics, and I love comics, I've been a comic fan pretty much my whole life, but there's the biggest thing that you always struggle with is continuity. There's continuity here. The thing that they did that Wagner, man, he's aged in real time. And so, yeah, they've done a few things to keep him around, but you don't have to worry about continuity in this. And I think that makes the most interesting and most compelling story, because you can go back to something that was 20 years ago and it's there, and you don't have to say, wait, which Earth was this on, and which time was this, and which Batman was this, and is this... It's this thing. And so the commentary gets to continue on, but it can also work as its own historical record. So there's a history of Mega City One that also exists. And so to me, there's very few things in the history of art, of modern art, that has that kind of well that you can go back to over and over, because it has its own history. I'm sure there is a history of Mega City One that exists, and it's real, where there's no history of Gotham, there's no history of Metropolis, those have all changed. So I think to me, that's what makes it this story in particular, but comic books in general, very compelling, is because there are always commentaries. But the reason this works is because when I started writing, I was like, oh, well, I could just go back. I mean, I'm writing Days of Chaos. I found something to pull from, you know, Prog 6, and it was still in canon. So it's brilliant. It's just brilliant, amazing, thoughtful work that takes an army of people to keep going. So there's tons of validity there.
One of the, just to build on that, you know, I loved all the essays. So, you know, no, there was no favorites, but
children are brilliant.
Yeah. That's very true.
Once he's off camera, then we'll find out.
Yeah. but one of the essays that was most interesting to discuss, actually, you've said it was about this, I'm going to have to find it, who wrote it now because it's on there, but it's called, How Mega City humanizes its characters through that continuity. You know, it was basically sort of like how we humanize them through death. And so I am going to sort of name check because I should really do that. Here you go. I'm just going to check in the bibliography. So here you go. Better Living Through Death by Santiago Mayad. So it was in that discussion that we had. Because we were trying to give it that comparison piece, because we were using Rob Williams' Hershey recent book two recently finished as our sort of baseline to say, here's a character that was introduced, you know, in the Judge Shell quest way in the beginning, and has literally grown to join the Council of Five. She's become a confidant of Dread. She became chief judge several times, and now she's having this sort of epilogue story. And they've aged her like Dread, like, you know, they've taken away the drugs and the medicine and now she's aging and stuff. And it was this sort of thing. And we were saying, well, that's actually really powerful that these characters have a life, you know, more so than any other character. I mean, we built a comparison to, like Batman and Nightwing and, you know, Red Hood. Yeah. Batman's now had this many, you know, Robins. And if you really want to sort of do it, as you were saying, sort of, you know, Tony, the history of Gotham's had to change. You have them all in 6 months. You know, at one point, like, all those Robins appeared between June and June and the next January in order to fit them all in. Maybe you can say, yeah, it's now, was it 2144, 2143? But Hershey was introduced in 21 whatever. And then she's had this life, like she has had an existence, and characters have died. You know? And so having this continuity, and the fact that things have an impact, like the fact that the Apocalypse War is still like had an impact. Day of Chaos, I'm sure, will come back in 10 years. It'll still have an impact. Characters come and go. You know, it's not, characters can be pulled back, not from the dead, but like come in and they do because they're working in different parts of the city or whatever. It's just such a fantastic web of existence. Like it literally feels like another existence you can step into and go, yeah, I'm going to go back to this period, and you know, it just exists. And I just find that fascinating, and that was one of the things that drove this book, was you can go, right, we're going to have a look at it from this angle, we're going to have a look at going footsie, so here's how living in Mega City One affects you, we're going to go back and look at all the different things from the stories around Boeing or the League of Fatties or all these other things. That's funny, but they're actually dealing with mental health. Like, you know, you look at the start of the Chopper, I think it's the first Chopper series. Chopper's mum, her hobby is washing dishes, then she dirties them to wash them again. Like, that's the thing she does to fill her time. And so you have all these little quirks and stuff in this living environment. It's more than any other comic world, it feels alive. And I think that's one of the most fascinating things around Mega City One.
One of the things we should talk about, particularly as we have Americans on this chat, is about this perspective. Because as you say, Scott, you know, there's people from all over the world who've contributed to this book. It's the hoary old thing of, well, Americans don't do satire, they don't do irony, they don't get Judge Dredd. But one thing that going to US shows, talking to a lot of Americans, even doing panels like the ones that I've done at San Diego and New York Comic Con, has taught me is that's absolute bollocks. But what it seems to me to be based on is the fact that most Americans' experience of Judge Dredd is the 1995 movie, or even, you know, the 2012 movie, which whichever one don't have that rich storytelling. Once they actually encounter the comic, they absolutely get it. But Julian, Tony, I wanted to get your perspective on this and about the Britishness of Dredd and whether that's part of the appeal, whether it gets in the way. You know, what's your take?
Go for it.
Okay. Well, for me, I always find it fascinating when outsiders look in. And so some of like my go-to news for American news is very rarely inside. Like I read The Guardian, you know, I like seeing what is somebody else saying, because I think you have no interest other than telling the truth. And so satire tells the truth. It doesn't always have to be a joke. It just has to be the truth, and it has to, you know, point the mirror back at you. So the reason I like Dredd so much, the reason I think Mega City One is fascinating, and why I want a Mega City One series, you know, as a show, because I want to see, I mean, Dredd should be in it, of course, but I just want to see these other lives that are living. What I find fascinating, I don't think the Britishness gets in the way, because I think it can tell the story in an honest way. The thing that I compare Dredd the most to, which is a book that is one of the best written American satires about war, is Catch-22. And that's American, looking at American war and the hypocrisy and nonsense of it. And most people hate that book. It's so honest and it's so real and it's painful and it's beautiful for all of those reasons. So for me, I think it's Heller, notwithstanding, there's a few other American satirists who do it well. I think for the most part, we need an outside perspective for us to actually be able to see ourselves. So I don't think it gets in the way. I think it only enhances the reality of the situation on the ground.
I think if there's one way that Americans struggle with Dredd, is that we are programmed to identify with the protagonist no matter what sins he commits, right? So, I mean, if he has created the villain, if he winds up shooting civilians, you know, we're going to get like some sense of catharsis in that Hollywood movie. And then, you know, we are programmed to understand, oh, good job, white guy. You know, you've apologized. It's all good. You're the hero again. And especially in mainstream American culture, we struggle with, as Americans, the concept that you can have an unlikable protagonist. I mean, obviously, you know, indie stuff does this all the time. And I don't think this is constitutionally a flaw in Americans, but our culture constantly pushes this agenda. And so I think given that, the sort of dominant American response to RoboCop is, yeah, he's badass, right? There are people who just don't get that there's satire there. And I think the same thing is true for Dredd. But that's not to say that plenty of Americans don't get it. I mean, I think growing up, I got it and I just assumed everybody knew, yeah, this would not be enjoyable. This is not okay. You're supposed to have questions. You're supposed to question your heroes. That's a lot healthier. But the flip side of that is that I assumed Britain always questioned its heroes, and that's not true either.
No, not at all, in fact. The last few years have taught us anything. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's on that point that I did want to get everyone's perspective, because the last few years have been very interesting. And thinking about, you know, not even just the last 18 months and seeing people's differing reactions to power structure and hierarchy.
Oh, sorry.
but also broader attitudes to the police. Do you think that's partly a stumbling block? Certainly culturally, a policeman in America is very different, perceived very differently to a policeman in Britain.
I was going to admit, I would say one of the things that's been interesting doing this, and also like, We kicked off doing this book with initial conversations and stuff. You know, me and Julian started reaching out, and I got like Tony and all the others. And then we had sort of, you know, the Black Lives Matter protests, and then the police, and then there was the reaction from the police. And in my head, Julian and I had this conversation at one point. We're like, is this the right time to be putting out a Dredd book? Like, you know, I don't want them to think we are glamorizing. Like, I want them to, you know, the book is called Judging Dredd. Like, we are literally judging his, you know, him. And so, you know, with everything that's gone on with this sort of, like, you know, the police brutality and, you know, the Blue Lives Matter and all this other stuff, it was very sort of like, I want to be clear about how we're approaching this character. Like, the essays do, there is an essay in there about the Cursed Earth saga and about that transition of him being a hero to being a, you know, or presented almost as a hero to then being presented almost as that sort of like strong fascist thing. But one of the things that came out bizarrely as I was, we were doing this in through discussions and stuff is, or at least this is in my opinion, is Americans love a cowboy and Dredd is not a cowboy. You know, when you look at these sort of like, you know, Dirty Harry, you know, Riggs out of, you know, Lethal Weapon, or you know, all the action heroes of sort of like Cobra, you know, I can name a bunch from the sort of like, you know, all those Chuck Norris, Sylvester, and all those sort of characters, they're very cowboyish, they're very Wild West. And Dredd is like, no, 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 I am the law. Like, I am authority and I follow the rules, you know, and that sort of thing. And I think part of it is that, that's not the, he's not the sort of the rogue element, you know, he's not the loose cannon that gets shouted at by his captain. Like, you know, he is the authority. He literally wrote that, you know, the, what's it called? His book of the law, the comportment of what it is to be a judge. So he's almost like the antithesis of the American cowboy cop. You know, so I find that fascinating as well, that sort of, he just doesn't fit that mold of what the Western hero should be.
Yeah, I agree. The thing about that too is, because the Black Lives Matter stuff came up in my essay a little bit too, because I'm writing about Days of Chaos and the argument that Wagner was essentially warning us, like, hey, there's two sides of this. Like, when you look in the Days of Chaos series saga, what happens is the people rise up and they rebel, and it's pushed down like that. But they go from protesting. There's this difference between protesting and speaking up, and then chaos and, you know, looting and rioting and like going from, I'm standing up for my rights and I'm going to stand in the street, I'm going to shout and yell and say, damn you fascists. Then you're like, oh, now I'm going to break windows and steal shit. And so I actually address that in my essay, because I think what's the Black Lives Matter movement is this positive protest thing. And then what happens is you have people who are saying, you know, let's smash windows and steal stuff. And then people are going, well, what's the moral ambiguity there? Is that okay? And then what are the police allowed to do? So I wanted to address it directly, because I think that's right. Is that you're like, well, if a cop goes in, if there's a protest and somebody starts breaking windows, a cop should probably show up and say, hey, the guy who owns that sporting goods store, you're not mad at him. Why are you taking his bats? Why are you smashing his window? You know, so I think where Dredd would, of course, go in and shoot them all. for taking the bats, not just, and so I think that's the thing that we struggle with, is like the difference between enforcing the law, like enforcing a law with reason, as opposed to doing it the way that Dredd does it, enforcing the law with impunity. And so people don't get that either, and they should. But that's why this book is important, because we need to have the conversation. There's a difference between, you know, using your head, and Dredd doesn't use his head. If the law changes, he will completely, you know, enforce the law completely 180. There's the one early on, remember, where he's like on vacation and he's walking through the streets and he's not, like, people are committing crimes and he's just walking past them because he's technically off duty, or he had been suspended temporarily. And then as soon as he's back on, he's like, you know, busting ass. Because again, for him, the written rules are the only thing that matters. And in America, you know, those things, the written rules change from state to state, of course. You know, Julie and I live in different states, so we have different state laws. My governor just signed it. This is totally true. My governor just signed a law that if you feel threatened by a group of three or more people, you can drive your car over them. And you know that's going to happen, and that will be the law. So it's just such an interesting
America, land of the free.
Yeah. I'm fully expecting Tony to be the Florida man runs over three people.
Oh, my God. I don't even leave the house most days.
Well, I mean, I just want to say that, you know, I think the point is very well made that Judge Dredd is not rogue cop. You know, he's not that guy. But also, we're talking about sort of cultural stereotypes. And just as we were talking, you know, earlier about you know, America versus Britain. I mean, these are sort of stereotypes. I live within an hour away from Ferguson, and I went to Ferguson. So, you know, the majority of Americans actually side with Black Lives Matter. And, you know, we are programmed to sort of like worship authority and, you know, sir and officer and all of that. But the flip side of that is that, you know, you look at polls, and even when Giuliani's speaking at the convention in 2016, he says, you know, when if a cop gets out of line, he should be punished. On the other hand, if he hasn't done anything wrong, he should. It's like, that's the Black Lives Matter position, actually, is that there should be a mechanism to punish that. So even when, and I don't think I'm speaking out of turn, even when the bad guys get up and try to justify, you know, cracking down and breaking heads, they do it through a language that seems to affirm there's no real reason to protest. We're already, you know, handling that. So it is true that we live in a culture in which, you know, people are a little more disposable. I mean, going back to like even Kent State, the majority of Americans when polled were in favor of shooting those kids by a slim majority. But that's changed now. So, I mean, our culture is conflicted. We do have a society in which, you know, we seem comfortable saying, if you can't afford cancer treatment, your job is to die. You know, sorry, bud. But the flip side is that most Americans don't agree with that. So I think these generalizations are, you know, more complex on the ground.
Scott, what's your thoughts?
Me or Scott? I didn't hear who you said. Sorry. Scott. Just in general. Okay. Yeah. No, I'm sorry. I agree. I think that that's true. I think that is what makes Dredd, everything that Julian just said, is so true. And that's what makes Dredd harder to read, is because there's no gray areas there. He only has one way. And so how can you like somebody who never says I'm wrong? How do you get behind somebody who never, when Scott and I first talked about Dredd, I mean, you know, he is a fascist. You're not supposed to like him. Like, it stresses me out if somebody who's got an I Am the Law shirt on and is wearing it unironically a little bit, not like as a love letter to Dredd, not like as a love letter to 2000 AD and the whole idea, but like, no, Dredd is right. Dredd is the law. You're like, dude, all right, I'm going to go away from you now because your other shirt under that says Rorschach was right. And so you're stressing me out. You know, so I definitely think we struggle sometimes dealing with it.
This thing of thing, like you say, this idea though, because the idea of Rorschach is, you know, he's totally right. This idea of like, oh yeah, Rorschach's badass, like he's that cool character. And you know, there's a quote from Alan Moore that's like, you know, when he's at conventions, the first person to say to him sort of like, you know, oh, Rorschach's the one I love, he'll just walk away. It's like, no, I'm not having that conversation because you've clearly not understood it. But it's the same as like, you know, they say when the police start using the Punisher symbol. And you're sort of like, you clearly haven't read, but you don't understand what it is you're representing. Like, you know, you know, it's not, you know, you're not playing it right. But I mean, if you think like in the Small House, like Judge Smiley calls him out, like, you know, he's like, no, we're fascists and we are in control and this is what we do. Like, you're a blunt instrument. Like, I'm thinking strategically and I'm trying to manage this mass of people and the way it's running. And you're out there cracking heads. You know, who's actually thinking about the future? Who's really thinking about the people? But what things I would say, I would sort of push back on what Tony says. I think, you know, in general, there's a generalization that Dredd is very black and white. But, you know, that's not wholly true. I mean, granted, he's had like 44 years of character progression.
Of course.
More than, say, any other character, really. But there has been moments when he, you know, we know he has stopped and considered, like, you know, letter to a Democrat and you know, he left. He you know, he went off and went to the cursed earth. And even now, like, you know, Dredd is more willing to see other perspectives as he gets older, from whether it be democracy or muti rights or the use of robot judges or whatever, like, you know, he's but that's taken, and again, going back to this idea of continuity, it's taken him 44 years to shift his character to shift his position. It's not like all of a sudden, you know, like a 90-minute movie of like, you know, here's my story arc, and by the end of it, I'm redeemed, and I now see everybody's point. He's like, no, he's a stubborn old bastard, and he is going to sort of, you know, have his position. However, again, to what you said, Tony, there'll be days when, like, you know, he might stand up for Muti rights, and he will protect or stop a group of you know, cursed earth refugees from being shot at or being sort of like, you know, attacked. And then on the way home, someone's going to drop a Sinti calf bar and he'll beat the crap out of them. So, yeah, it swings and roundabouts. But, you know, he is a developing character. And so there's this thing that there is the grey, or there's the growing grey in Dredd. And I think sort of as he gets older, I think that creeps in more and more. I think you see it more. And I think Rob Williams has really brought it in, as has Wagner. But that's something I find fascinating, that, you know, as a developing person, you should start to question things, and we should start to question our place in the universe and, or, you know, in life. And weirdly, I see, you know, it's that thing again, sorry to go on, but we keep hearing this thing of like, you know, I don't like politics in my comics. You know, I don't like it that Captain America's become political. I don't like that Judge Dredd's become political. And you sort of go, I don't think you read the same Dredd I was reading in the sort of like in the 80s and 90s. And, you know, you can read it as the pulps, but it's always been there. And now it's becoming a little bit, in times like this, it just seems to become, when you are living through those times and you are more aware of the sort of the political and the social climate, it just becomes a bit more obvious. I mean, I was born in 1981. You know, I wasn't around for like, you know, or I wasn't sort of conscious of like the Brixton riots and the sort of like, you know, Thatcher's influence. I was just concerned she was taking my milk away. You know, that was my concern. And then, but when you look back on it, you have to understand the time in which those stories are being told. And so when you get younger people going, well, it was Dredd being Dredd. No, it was a reflection of the times. And I find that this time has been useful for Dredd to be more relevant. So yeah, I think you know, I think from an American, I think the Americans do get it. I think, yeah, these two sort of represent that. But I also think sometimes the times can represent him better than others. You know, in times of sort of peace or quieter times, I think sort of like the satire sort of, you know, isn't as cutting, maybe.
I just want to briefly second that notion that Dredd is more complex than we sometimes make him out to be. That, you know, I mean, he insisted on a vote of putting the judge system up for a referendum. You know, people didn't turn out, but he insisted on that. And he lets people off all the time. I mean, we see a sort of prosecutorial discretion, if you will, used all the time. And yeah, sometimes he's a hard nose, but I don't know that I hate Judge Dredd. I mean, I kind of like him, and, you know, but he seems to have a kind of version of a conservative mentality that's like, okay, look, if the law isn't fair, change the law. You know, I'm here to enforce the law. You know, and I can understand that. It doesn't account for our broken politics, and, you know, it's not my mentality, but it's not necessarily, he's not an evil man, you know?
No, I don't think he's evil either. I think what you just said is exactly right, Julian, because it's like the one that I keep coming back to, I always just, because I love that issue. I wish I remember which progress it was, where he's like strolling through town and they almost draw him almost with the smile on his face because he's like off duty, as it were. And it was like such an interesting look at, this is how, like, the rule says I'm off, so therefore I'm not gonna enforce the law. I've seen crime happen. I don't care, citizen, moving along, kind of thing. But then as soon as he's back on duty, then he is that. And I think you're right that there's something about somebody who knows who he is. And right, if the law's unjust, let's change the law. But until you do, that's the law. And I'm the law, and I have to enforce it. And so it's not as though he's saying don't change or don't move. And I think what we see with Days of Chaos in particular, you know, that was the chickens coming home to roost, right? Because he's the one who made the decision in the first place to blow everything up in Europe, which is what leads to Days of Chaos, whatever it was 20 years later. And so he's, at the end of that, he's changed because he's like, oh, well, I made the total black and white. I made the right decision then. I don't think he regrets making that decision, but he's like, oh, actions have consequences in a way that I didn't really think of before. And so because, as you mentioned earlier, Scott, how human he is and how human everybody in Mega City One is that gives him an opportunity as a grumpy old man to be like, well, maybe I can still learn something. So it is an interesting look at it. And it makes the concept, like in our country too, you know, the word phrase, Julian, you know, the phrase law and order coined by Nixon means something different than it means written down. Like law and order, you're like, yeah, we're all pro law and order. Who wouldn't be for that? Like you said earlier, it's the language you use, but the way that Nixon used it, the way that Giuliani used it, it means something different. And the way that Dredd uses it is the way that normal people think law and order means. This is the law. I am the order. I'm going to follow the law. And that's that. So he is right. I mean, I don't necessarily say that I like him. I don't hate him, but I wouldn't invite him over for tea anytime soon, I would say.
Isn't that the central point, though, that it's all very well to say, well, don't break the law and you won't get hurt. But the law in Mega City One is designed to create lawbreakers by making it so physically impossible. You know, there's several stories. I'm thinking not just in 2000 AD, but also in the Daily Star newspaper strips, where Dredd stops somebody and, you know, checks up on them with control. And it comes back and says, oh, you know, you've got yourself a model citizen there. And there's always that element of, well, I'm sure there's some around. The whole process of living in Mega City One is designed to make you a criminal. Yeah. So isn't that the satire, the arbitrariness of the power of the policeman and of the law is that it doesn't matter how good you are and careful you are, the system is going to criminalize you. And for me, that's you know, even before the last 18 months or 2 years, that was something that I'd read some stuff about with you know, Black Lives Matter, the experience of a black person living in Britain and America is one of arbitrary harassment and persecution. So to a certain extent, do you not think that the law is the excuse? When he says, I am the law, he's the one in charge of making the law. You know, the judges, it's all very well to say, well, don't break the law, but literally the police enforcing them are the ones who were setting them in the first place.
Yeah, I get you mean. It's almost like, yeah, you're set up to fail as a citizen of Mega City One. I mean, you know, you get random... you know, crime raids where they'll just turn up at your, you know, your flat or your, you know, your apartment, and then they'll raid for everything. And if you know, they find you've got some sort of like sugar synth or some, you know, coffee substitute or something else, all of a sudden you're off to the cubes for something as ridiculous as that. And it might even be yours; it could be the previous tenant's doesn't catch in your apartment. Yeah, you are set up to fail. The things are, there's a cool. I remember there's an issue where Dredd's getting a physical. And there's a comment in that that's basically sort of like, yeah, he's fine, you know, we're using these drugs to keep him young and he's got the body of a whatever year old, you know, da, da, da. But then they're like, well, what about psychologically? And they're basically like, just be grateful he's on our side and he's got a structure to work in because he's basically a savage.
Well, there's Alone in the Crowd, that classic Steve Dillon story where, you know, it draws a direct line between the power of the judge and the power of the criminal. They're behaving the same way and the citizens are terrified. And, that always struck me as being a very clear message from Wagner and Grant. You know, these two things are two sides of the coin. One is not light and the other darkness. It's they're employing the same kind of power with people, you know?
Yeah. Oh, totally. That's totally true. I think what's really what happens is that you create a power structure. I mean, you're saying it's like the two sides of the same coin, but it's based on a power structure that you know, if you're the tail side, as it were, if you're the citizen side, it's that if you're stuck in Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead. It's always going to come up heads no matter what you do. So the power structure is it looks like it's two sides of the same coin, but you can never win. You're never going to win the coin toss because the odds are always against you. Because like you said, not only are you enforcing them, but you're enacting them. And yeah, you have no idea when you're going to be breaking a law. And you think about in our country, the amount of people who were incarcerated during the three strikes and you're, I don't know if you guys know what the three strikes and you're out rule is if it was like just basic, just you were like had a dime bag or whatever, three of those, you're in jail for 20 years. There are people who are just getting out of jail, spent 20 years nonviolent criminals for something that is currently legal in most states. But are those people weren't released. You know, like they were just kept because it's like, well, at the time it was the law. So even though now we've made that legal, you did something that at the time was illegal that didn't harm anyone but yourself, you're still in jail. And so we definitely have created a system where, you know, just living your life is going to be criminal for sure.
I also think, say, you know, from my experience, you know, that's your experience, but from my experience as well, you know, to sort of think this idea of what you're saying, Michael, is like, the government's reaction to Scott Tedder's satire, especially as a kid, is like anything that the government didn't like, they just criminalised. You know, to put it in the most sort of like silly of terms, is like, you know, the video nasties, don't like these films, they're banned. And if you're found with them, you can do time. You could literally, do, you know, they became like a contraband of video cassettes. And people and video shops were raided to find these things, to find, you know, zombie Holocaust, even like the, you know, Evil Dead, like films that are readily available now on 4K Blu-ray from somewhere. And so there is this instant, like you say, it's not, you know, you're set up to fail, but also it's almost like the instant response of something's created. We're not sure how to deal with this, so we're going to criminalize it because it makes it easier to sort of manage. And basically, if the law is you don't do it, and if you're found doing it, well, it's the law, then you're a criminal. So it's almost like it's not only they set up to fail, it's almost like an easy response. It's a lazy response. Like, yeah, and the thing about them with Mega City One is it's they're not going to look at the social consequences or even the social implications or the social, you know, they're not going to look at the root cause. They're just like, oh, well, we don't want, you know, candy, some, you know, Otto Sum's candy and all this other stuff. Like, no, it's got these effects, get rid of it. Okay, it's now criminalized.
Well, just, I mean, we come to the root then of the whole law and order agenda that, you know, we've already named Nixon, but of course LBJ had his own war on crime, war on poverty. Then Nixon came along with the war on drugs, and it's that the simplicity of, well, there's a problem, so there must be a solution, and the solution is probably going to be hitting it. And Reagan, who of course was governor of California during the Berkeley University protests, you know, that was his response. And then he becomes president. But one thing I've been reading a lot of recently is about the broken windows policies of James Q. Wilson, who of course Dredd preceded Wilson's main theory by a number of years, but it's that you can see it reflected, that notion of so those who don't know, broken windows is where it's the idea that a single broken window in a neighborhood is an indication that the neighborhood is unprotected by society and the law, and so it encourages further crime, so you then have a sliding scale upwards. And by and large, it's bollocks. You know, and there's been lots of work to prove that it is, but it has such a hold over our imagination. And, you know, for me, and I realize I'm running out of time here, and I've gone off on one, but Dredd is a satire of that. It's as if you say, the idea of a simple solution. I've really enjoyed this book, which is the punitive term, Turn in American Life by Michael Sherry, because that's a history of the law and order narrative, and the idea that we have become so punitive now that actually we don't even care if anyone's broken the law. We just want to see them punished.
Yeah.
Because it makes life simple. Like we don't have to examine the social causes of why they've done what they've done. It just hit them with your billy club, mate, you know?
Well, it comes even at every level. Like, you know, it's also a sort of thing that was, you know, when you're parenting, sort of the ease of punishment before, you know, against the sort of the tediousness of teaching your children. You know, if your kid doing something ever again, yes, yeah, I know smacking's not, you know, is against the law. Like, I don't smack my kid, but like that thing of like punishment, all right, I take that away, you know. You know, go to your room. You know, you can't play your computer game. You can't have your pudding. You can't have this. Do whatever. There's a punishment. And you're not addressing. You're not going, well, actually, we're going to educate you. I'm going to tell you why you can't do what you're doing. Like, you know, it's dangerous, or, you know, it's, you know, we don't have the resources for you to do that, or, you know, you can't do this, whatever. There's no education. It's just, that's wrong. And I'm telling you it's wrong. And, you know, go to bed, or go to the cubes, or go to the, you know, you go to the cells. Yeah. It's, you know what I mean? But that's what it is, isn't it? It's this, it's the punitive is easy, which is where we end up incarcerating so many people. Unfortunately, and I don't know how it worked, you know, I don't think there's ever been a, I can't think of, I'd love to see this sort of life in the cubes, like an in cube sort of story. But like, you know, when people do go into prison, it's a known fact that you could go in for a simple crime. And because you spend 6 months, a year in there associating with other, for want of a better phrase, criminals and other, you know, people in different lives, you come out and you go, yeah, whilst I was in there, I now know this, or I've, you know, I'm, and because I'm, I've now got this on my record, I can't get that job. And so I'm being pushed down into further criminality, or I'm pushed into a different situation where I'm going to receive another punitive response. And this is, that comes back to this thing you say about, there was a really good story recently, actually, of the, you know, the ex-judge served his time on Titan and was working in the sewers, and Dredd was hounding him, saying that, well, there's no such thing as a good, as a redemptive former judge, you know. And he was hounding him, and it's obviously he was a, you know, good judge or whatever. But that's the thing, isn't it? Like, you know, if you're spotted to have a criminal record, or you've had some punitive, you know, action against you, then it's a stain. And if anything, it's going to push you down a ladder. It's not going to go, well, you've there's no such, there's this crap about I've served my time, or you've served your time into society, and now you're back into it. No, 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 you've served your time, but that's going to hang around your neck like an albatross for the rest of your life. And that's the real sadness of it. And that's reflected in Mega City One as well.
Julian, you look like you've got a point to make.
Yeah, I just want to, I mean, the whole thing about, you know, broken windows also gives a justification, you know, for saying what I did of, you know, well, it's against the law, but also that if you crack down on minor things, those people who you're arresting are, you know, in theory committing other crimes, right? And so this gives this justification for endless policing. We've talked about Black Lives Matter, but we haven't addressed, especially in terms of the police dynamic, but we haven't addressed race. And I was listening to an interview about Dredd recently that said that, you know, Dredd is actually really utopian, in that you don't see a lot of racism. You know, for all of the problems of, I see the looking askance, but for all of the problems of Mega City One, you know, you don't have permanent classes and a permanent underclass defined, except for like mutants or something, defined by skin color. And so when we're talking about this oppression, you know, when you're talking about this, you know, sort of everybody is a criminal. I mean, that's exactly the dynamic of Ferguson. That's exactly the dynamic of over-policed areas in the United States, where, you know, if police pull me over, you know, it's, do you know you were going over the limit? They give me a ticket or not. In Ferguson, it's, you know, your rims aren't quite right. This isn't quite right. It's exactly that Judge Dredd thing. And then here are these tickets. Now you're in the system. You've got to go to the, not the cues, but you got to go to the courthouse. You got to pay fees. You know, and now you're caught up, and then there are, you know, additional citations for it. And it's a very Judge Dredd like system. And I think that dynamic of the judges looking at everybody as already a criminal, which you do see over and over again, does reflect that reality, even if it's not directly shot through with racial dynamics.
Well, I mean, there's a word for society that completely covers over all differences, and that's called totalitarianism,
yeah,
which is also another aspect to Judge Dredd's system. I'm conscious that we're coming to the end of our time, but one thing I did want to ask about, because we've kind of talked generally as opposed to specifically about the essays that you guys have done. I wanted to ask you individually whether doing the essay, because obviously you had to have a pitch, you had an idea about what you wanted to write about and the angle that you wanted to take. I wanted to find out whether that process changed your mind, or whether there was something surprising that you came across, or you know, that perhaps you started arguing yourself out of your original position. Tony, let's go with you first.
Yeah, I will go. Yeah. because I'm actually gonna have to jump off after this. So I appreciate it, Mike. I'm sorry. I'm gonna have to go before it's over, but I've got work, lame. But yes, for me, 100%. As I said, my original pitch was going to be mostly just about the privacy issues and the way that the PSU worked. And as I started digging in, which is, again, brilliant, that the PSU is way back, you know, Judge Jura is way back, like, you know, or Judge Edgar from like Prog 6. It's insane. So for me, it's when I started that way, thinking that's what I'm going to do. I'm only going to focus on the PSU. And as I started to understand this like warning that Wagner was giving us and the way that we interact with ourselves online, and then like, how does something simple, like I'm just going to talk about privacy, really turn into like, how do we rebel? How do we react to a fascist system? So it made me look at not only just the story I wanted to tell evolved completely, but then like myself, and I can bring some of that into my classroom and some of the conversations we have. It's like, well, you know, how can one small germ of an idea become something else? And what I really thought most about, I know this makes no sense, but was the difference between protesting and rebelling. Because I think Days of Chaos really, really, without using either of those words, it's right there. Some of the people are just depressed and they just want to protest. And they just want to say, quit treating me like shit. And some people are like, let's just go burn everything to the ground. And so I wasn't expecting that I would leave writing this essay having really deep thoughts about the difference between a protest and a rebellion, and which one would I prefer to see? I still don't have a good answer, but at least it made me thinking about it.
Cool. Julian, what about yours? Because you wrote about the dark judges, didn't you?
Yes, I got you know, the best subject in the world, Judge Death. I mean, how can you not be in love with Judge Death as a villain? I think for me, you know, what was surprising, because I reread virtually every Judge Death appearance, and I think what was surprising for me was how I had remembered all those early stories as just unmitigated classics. And then, you know, there were things that I didn't know that I wanted to return to in the in-between years. And for me, what I found was, you know, even those early stories are, you know, brilliant. I still love them. They've got such, you know, they set up so much, but they also have clunky elements, and you see the evolution of the strip. And then some of those later stories have brilliant ideas that, even if it doesn't quite come off, or I'm not as much of a fan of it in comparison, there's so much creativity there. And so for me, seeing that evolution played out and seeing ideas that become so important to these characters introduced in a story that might not work completely, I think really illustrated for me how 2000 AD has let these characters evolve. And through all of these iterations and all of these new brains coming and trying to do another take, it reveals things about the characters, and little bits get brought forward and transformed into new elements that we can't imagine the stuff without.
Because it was one of the things, I've not actually got to your essay yet, I'm afraid. I'm slowly, I've got so much more reading to do. I'm only slowly working my way through the essays. But one thing that's always fascinated me about Death is the kind of the hinted at, the implied element of, well, this is what you end up with Dredd's logic. Like, this is the logical endpoint of Judge Dredd, you know. And he's presented as an extreme, as a contrast to Dredd himself, but actually you follow through, that's where you end up, you know.
Well, you'll definitely like the essay then, because that is the through line through the whole thing, is Death as, you know, not just you know, in some ways an opposite, but also the embodiment of a kind of criticism of the judge system, that every time you want to kind of like pin down, what exactly is it that you're objecting to about the dark judges? It's like, yeah, but that also applies to you, brother.
Scott, what about you? I mean, obviously you've got an oversight on the whole thing, but also contributing your own piece. Has there been something that has actually, you know what? Let's deal with this separately. So let's talk about your essay, and then we'll talk about the process of editing them. When you were writing, because you write about technology and things like the Mechanismo program and robots in Judge Dredd's world, was there something that really hit you during the course of the process?
Yeah, I mean, you know, because I love the first like Mechanismo story. You know, is a classic. I like that idea, and I thought, yeah, you know, robot judges are you know, it's a great idea, and you know, like this idea of technology coming into our life and this other thing. And it, to me, the starting point was just that. It was like, oh yeah, Dredd Standish, he doesn't trust them, you know. But then why not? Like, you know, that was the question I went to sort of start to approach. But as I dug into it, like I did a whole bunch of research about current technology, you know, not even like bleeding edge, not like, you know, the stuff we don't see, but like stuff that's going on. And it was a massive eye opener to me that I was like, oh no, you know, for me, robotics in factories is those big yellow arms you see put in the cars together. And I think they're pretty clever. And then I find out, oh no, Ford has an actual robot that carries boxes and walks around on two legs. And you know, it's called Digit, I think. So, you know, and I was like, all right, that's creepy. And then, you know, the more it came was like this thing around, there was a survey done about a bunch of things, questionnaire, and this thing of within the next couple of years, automation can take a bunch of jobs away. You know, we're all an algorithm away from losing our jobs. But then 70% of people are actually willing to have both brain and or physical augmentation in order to keep their job. And so to me, the thing that sort of the development of the essay came to this thing of this morality line of where do we draw the line? Dredd is the line. And even he starts to sort of step back with the introduction of the later judges, the later robot judges. But like, you know, we'll go mobile phones, you know, I'm not sure how I feel about this, the amount of sort of, you know, tracking or anything that can be done on my phone. More, I'm really uncomfortable with that. How long have you had a phone? 10 years. Oh, okay. Are you really that worried about it? No. And then, you know, well, what about your laptop? What about your tablet? All this technology that's increased, Alexa, Google, whatever, Siri, all this stuff that permit. I was like, this morality line just keeps creeping up. And it's sort of like, we're all against it. You'll see all the essays or all the articles against it. And then we see the benefits or we see the entertainment value and the morality line crept. And that's what drove me, was this idea then of like, as you say about the inevitable, what is the inevitable of this, of where does this thing, you know, why is Judge Dredd against this idea of robot judges, and what is going to push that morality line back? And it gets there. You know, there's more recent stories with machine law in particular, where you meet the new versions, the most recent versions, where they've got a personality, they've got compassion, and actually the robot judges are probably a bit more, you know, human, inverted commas, than the actual judges. It starts to sort of, you know, this interesting complexity between them. So I just find that fascinating. And it was just a really sort of a rabbit hole to go down. And yeah, so that was a great experience to sort of write that essay.
And in terms of bringing it all together, were there any areas that you wish you had been able to address with an essay from someone?
Writing the essay or editing the essays was interesting because it's my first real experience. Like I've done stuff for my own things. I've got podcasts and I've written blogs and that. So I've always tried to sort of, you know, improve my skills with those. But having the responsibility of editing somebody else's work, to me, it was twofold. It was like, well, I'm responsible for this book. My name's on the front. It's got to be quality. You know, Julian's got to sign off on it, so it can't be crap. I've got to do a good job. However, there was this question about what gives me the right to actually question and give feedback to someone who is probably, you know, more academically, you know, able than me. And so there was that was sort of at play quite a bit. But then everyone we worked with was fantastic, open to discussion, open to feedback, open to sort of the ideas that we had. But there was when I got the list together, when we had that list of all the essays, I had another, I think, six or seven I'd come up with later. Then there was like, when I had that original list, it was like, here's the proposals or here's the possible ideas. And then people could pitch their own ideas. But I ended up with like six, I think, left that were on that original list that people didn't pick up. And there were all kinds of things on there from, God, you're trying to remember now. You know, there was more stuff we wanted to do from some of the 90s stuff. There was like, I wanted to do an essay on some of the sort of the the idea of humor in Dread, especially in that sort of like the early 90s, a bit more wacky stuff that sort of came around. I'd love to have done more on that. Didn't get to cover Necropolis. It was a story time. We didn't really get to go into space. There was a couple of things where I was like, there was an idea for an essay I really wanted to cover about the judicial system across the world. You know, so we see the mega city ones, but then we also know there's like Judge Armitage and the justice system in Britsit, or, you know, the Australian system or the Irish system, or, you know, the weird Egyptian, North African Egyptian system from Grant Morrison and Mark Millar. So there's these ideas. I was like, those ones I'd like to do. So to be fair, there's probably enough for like a volume two. And also one of the things that was really interesting was, I say, as we were doing this and pulling this together, and as Tony said, there was just this sort of reflection on the times in which we live that I was like, when we get through this, there needs to be a reflection on this to say, how have we gotten through this, and what have we learned, and what were those stories during this time? I'd love to do a piece that said the stories from like 2016 to 2021 or 2020 that say through this period of, you know, not just the Trump years, but like, you know, the Conservative government and the pandemic and everything else we've gone through, like, how did Dread represent that? And I think that's something I'd really like to revisit in the future. So, you know, it's on video now. Julian's just given the thumbs up, so I take that as a Sequoia green light.
Legally binding, I think.
Yes, yeah. I believe so.
Well, thanks so much to Tony, Julian and Scott for that chat. Always great to have different perspectives on the future's greatest lawman. So do pick up a copy of Judging Dread if you can. We will be back in 7 days' time with another blast from the past with Angelic, the new series of Angelic starting in the Judge Dread magazine. We revisit an interview with writer Gordon Rennie way back when in the midst of time to talk about that series. And also Robin Smith, who has recently had artwork in the 2080 sci-fi special. Big bumper interview with him from a few years ago, where we go over his career, not just as an artist, but also as one of the editorial droids at 2000 AD, someone who was there for 2000 AD's Golden Age. So wonderful to revisit those chats. If you're not picking up the magazine, what are you doing? It's fantastic. It's had such a great run recently, and particularly with things like Devil in War, the return of Angelic. You know, there'll be more Lawless in the future, Dan Abnett and Phil Winslade. So make sure you're picking that up every month or add it to your subscription. Some great deals on Combi subscriptions on the 2080 website. As I say, we should be back in 7 days' time. Until then, Earthlets, keep staying safe. Look out for the interesting weather and Splendid Vertwig.
Alert! 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 Fill power levels dangerously high. Alert! Alert! Read 2000 AD every week. Ask your comic book store or newsagent now. Subscribe to the galaxy's greatest comic at 2000adonline.com.